maybe because of the questions that have been raised, it might be useful to have a workshop with the old exco of the department, so that we can then assist the committee to go in depth in terms of each and every one of these. And I think we agree to that. And I think I've just spoken to the secretary. We have agreed that we will look for a date in the next 2 weeks in which the department will then have a workshop. And 2 weeks because there are a number of things. One, obviously we have to prepare an annual report based on the KPIs. But secondly, in early March, the minister is supposed to table the strategic plan of the department. So it might be ideal maybe in the next week or two, maybe probably 2 weeks, to just have that workshop, go thoroughly through the issues and then revise accordingly, so that whatever is tabled, at least would have benefited from the advice and input of the committee. So I would propose that maybe going forward on this, completing the presentation might not be helpful because we'll do the same thing again when we have a workshop.
Honourable members.
Chair, we are happy with the workshop. Would we perhaps know where the venue will be?
No, we didn't decide. We'll decide on the venue and the date on the
calendar.
You know, I still think we should complete.
Okay.
But maybe that from our side as members, we don't go into as much detail. I think where there's... Huh? Okay, it's my side of the member, then, sorry. I think where, like, for example, that policy issue, developing policy, and I've said I don't think that should even be a KPI, I think that's something we can raise, but where there's something glaring, let's raise it, but let's still run to complete the exercise. I think there's only a few more pages to go.
Yeah, I think you've only got up until 37.
I think the next one was going to be on 21, on civil justice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's carry on.
All right.
And we
will, from our side, then, given that we're going to have this workshop, we won't be as critical and analytical as we have been since we've begun this process. All right.
Thank you. I think the next KPI chair was on output 21 on the review of the civil justice system. We said that we want to review simply because we want to increase the efficiency of the civil justice system. At the moment, I'm aware that the terms of reference of the review has been approved by cabinet. I know that there was a structure that was proposed to assist with the review, consisting of both internal and external stakeholders. I don't think that committee for review has been, I'm not aware if it has been finalized. I think I just need to check that. But we intend producing a report on this by March. I think our initial target was, I think the document has been approved of the terms of reference, and we had hoped to produce a national report by March 2011. I think the only thing that I must check is whether the committee that was supposed to set up to drive this is currently operational. But these are issues that we'll clarify when we come back in the workshop. The next output chair is output 23 on increasing resolution for on ensuring qualitative and timely justice services.
Sorry, just to come in, I didn't raise the point, but I think it's something that's the exclusion of output 22, which was the reason it's missing is because they're saying it belongs to the NPA, and that's where I'm disagreeing. I see on the old output 22, output 22 was increased case finalization for criminal cases, broad, okay? Then 22.1 was admissions of guilt, and I think that could be NPA. but definitely 22.2, increased finalization of lower court criminal cases by 2% in 2010. That's not just NPA. That needs to remain as a KPI for the department, because it involves court services and things like that. And I think there are a few other ones as well. You've also gone 24, 25, 26 have also been removed.
Before we proceed on along the line of thinking, can we comment on 21?
Oh, all right. Fine, go ahead.
21 talks about the protection of the national report on the deficiency in the current system. This will be assumed that the report will also contain recommendations as to what needs to be done or planned. The way it is, how severe it is, has an impression that we will be dealing with deficiencies and then so what.
Okay.
Yeah. Please note that your
team is. No, note that. Note that, sir.
All right. And you've noted also comments about KPIs 22 and 24, 25, and 26.
26, yeah. And 26, yeah. Thanks, Chair. Maybe just go back to the question. I think the idea of a national report on deficiencies was not only to provide a descriptive report. I think we had recommendations in mind, because if you look at the ultimate objective was to improve efficiency of the system. But we'll phrase it better, as Nkosi Holomisa indicated. With regard to ensuring qualitative and timely justice services, we have set ourselves a goal of reducing case backlogs in priority courts. We wanted to reduce the number of backlog cases in all courts. For 2010-2011, we wanted to reduce it by 38,000 cases. 2011-2012, that's 5,000 cases. 2012-2013, that's 1,000 cases. And 2013-2014, 28,000 cases. The way we hope to do it, Chair, is by increasing the number of backlog courts. We have set up a number of backlog courts, but obviously if you set up backlog courts, they also have implications for capacity. We need to increase capacity, employ more prosecutors who will then assist with this. Then,
courts are not the same. I would have preferred a KPI which said so many for magistrates, so many for regional, so many for high.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair, we are happy about the backlogs, but I would like to request the department to have a close look at inquests. I've attended a few courts in my constituency, and I found that inquests are 5, 6, 7 years old. And you can imagine the trauma of the victims.
In the same vein, Dr. De Vere, is there buy-in by all the role players? You know, I mean, I've given a little bit of thought to this. I'm not saying I have the solution, but is everyone, all the role players, on this particular matter, that is the reduction of case backlogs, do they have buy-in? I mean, do defense lawyers, the presiding officers, if you ask the prosecutor, he or she will say, of course. But my sense is that not everyone is buy-in. For the smallest reason, a defense lawyer will say, well, I want an adjournment. And there you go. It's not on the court roll for the next 6 months. And sometimes those of us who are not lawyers, we look at these time limits and we say, goodness, eh? And that's bothering.
You know, just speaking as somebody who's not intimately involved day-to-day with case flow management issues, I keep getting a sense that more needs to be done to ensure communication on this, because I still pick up issues of theft, issues of how far the department can go to tell the magistrates, the judges to prioritize this matter. I still keep picking that up. So my view is that I think a lot more still needs to be done to ensure common vision without crossing the boundaries, so to speak, without undermining the independence of the judiciary. Because the issue of
base. The office of the Chief Justice and also
I'm sorry, we are now going to stray into a little bit of substantive discussion again. But yes, the slightly longer term answer, of course, is to hand over the running of the courts to the judiciary, including the magistracy. And then matters of turf will fall away and the right people will be in charge. I just wanted to remind you of something. Debbie and I have had sight of an analysis from the highest ranks of the magistracy that points out that the real problem with this backlog business was a misdiagnosis in the term of the previous deputy minister. The magistrates say, and Debbie, I don't recall whether this was confidential. It's a documented, but just be prudent about it. But they say there were not enough presiding officers. That was the problem. Instead of which, the departments sometimes turn into empires. The department appointed more and more and more people in the department, and any number of other plans were made, and KPIs and this, that, and the other. Meantime, the real problem was there weren't enough magistrates. Now I know Debbie and company have been appointing more magistrates now, but if you don't diagnose that problem correctly, you're going to end up with endless interventions. And if there's a turf war or there's a turf factor, then it probably dates from those days where a department was growing and growing and growing, and the magistrates clearly were frustrated. But I mean, that's something else to keep in mind. Sometimes more appointments is not the answer. Filling vacancies is not always the answer. You've got to diagnose the problem correctly.
This is the sort of almost core function of the Department of Justice. I mean, that's not saying that civil matters are not important, but the flow of the criminal justice system. And I think the issue that comes up is it's no use just saying, it's rephrasing, I think, what Dina said. It's no use saying this is what we're going to do about the backlog. Number one, why is there a backlog? Okay, and I mean, I don't necessarily agree with Dean that the answer is well, hand it all over to the independent to the magistrates and judges to administer themselves, because you might find that they get arrogant and decide, one of the issues may be court hours. That they're only sitting for so many hours in court. Why? It could be that the magistrate says, no, I need to, it takes me a long time to write my judgment and I need to consult all the books. But in which case one would say, well, do it at night, do it after hours, take the books home with you. But really the bottom line I'm saying is let's have when we have this workshop, let's have an analysis on what are the reasons for the problems. And maybe have inputs from the NPA, the Magistrates Commission, and court services, or let court services coordinate it. What are the problems? Then we can come up with solutions. But then following on from Prof's point about the inquests, it would be useful also getting figures of the backlogs of things like inquests, as he's asked, but also other applications. So one of the other things that magistrates do is they do foster care grants. What are the backlogs? How long does it take when a social worker produces the file to say that child X should be then in the foster care of adult B? How long is the waiting period? It'll vary, I'm sure, court to court, but is there a backlog? Because obviously one wants that to run fairly speedily. If there's a backlog, why is there a backlog, and so on? So I think this is an important area, but I think it's not just throwing an output, an objective output and a KPI at us. We need greater analysis on something like this, which is core work.
See, again, we can spend a lot of time, and this is an issue. You know, over the last 10 years, backlogs comes up continually. There have been some very good programs over that period. One thinks of the Saturday courts, for example. You indicated that you'd have to appoint additional personnel, but Saturday courts work very well, and we'd like to hear, is that not a cost saving? You don't have to appoint additional officers, but you pay overtime. Also, the fact of presiding officers, there's been a shortage of them, but all their admin work has now been taken away from presiding officers. They don't do that for the last 5 or 6 years. So their admin work is all now by office managers. They don't do any admin work whatsoever in running their courts.
And I agree with you that there's a problem with the quality on the basis of what we've seen. There's a problem with the kind of people appointed to do this. And then the whole thing collapses, do you see?
We can have a constructive engagement around it, but it's an ongoing issue. There have been good solutions in the past. Let's apply what was used in the past again. Let's look at this. Obviously, the spin-off again is on other departments. Correctional services are forever pointing their finger at us. The waiting trial prisoner problem, huge, because of the backlogs. So you've got this huge awaiting trial prison problem in the prisons, overcrowding of the prisons, deplorable conditions that starts with us here. So we can have a very good discussion around that and find solutions to the issues.
Well, I think the reason it was taken away from the magistrates, Honourable Dean Smith, is because magistrates themselves held this up as one of the reasons why there was such a huge backlog and said, look at all the admin work I have to do. And so this committee with the department said, fine, then let us help you and take it away from you.
Yeah, it was a constitutional court decision that said it's not their duty to...
There you go.
Remember that? That
yes.
Was a clear split.
But if if there's an added challenge of the quality of persons being appointed, then that should be one of the things we must look at. That should be one of the things. But I agree with Steve Swart and the rest of you. This is an issue we need to apply our minds very constructively and positively. Because the overcrowding and awaiting trial prisoners stems directly from this. And it's right now, it's almost out of control. Yeah. All right, Mr. Devi, we're looking for solutions here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Chair. I think the next issue is the maintenance issue. And we feel that this is a service delivery issue, and we feel that we need to comply with what the Batupili principles have guided us to do. The target that we have set for ourselves is to ensure that 80% of applications are resolved within 20 days of entry date. And I think we have changed it over a period of time to say, I think in the next 5 years, every year we want to be 20% above baseline. With regard to the percentage increase in the utilization of civil enforcement of maintenance orders, we would like to be 20% above baseline each and every one of the 5 years. But generally speaking, the issue of maintenance, I think, is a priority area for us, and it's such an important priority area that we want to strengthened even our capacity on this, because if you look generally from the prosecution side and even from justice side, I think we need to up our game, because most of our complaints here are around the issue of maintenance, Chair.
Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Devi, if you seriously want to up your game, then this is a very strange way of going about it. I mean, you're taking away something very positive, ensuring that 80% of applications are resolved within 20 days, and replacing it with something completely different, which is not addressing the initial problem. It doesn't help increasing your percentage in utilizing civil enforcement of maintenance orders when there aren't even any maintenance orders in place in the first place. And that is where the problem is. 60% of order applications last year were not even finalized. So it doesn't help enforcing the order when you don't have an order to enforce. And I really think that this is completely retrogressive. it's not addressing your issue at all. And I think it's really very, very unacceptable, because your problem is in the initial phase, and that was well addressed by your first KPI, which is clearly not being met. So now you just change it to make it easier and totally different. With the greatest of respect, I think it's not at all helpful.
I mean, mine is that, look, maintenance is a major issue, but the solution that the department is coming with is not really getting to the root of the problem. So, I mean, I have some knowledge of maintenance matters as well from a sort of constituency level, and as far as I can see it, one of the problems is, if you take KZN, you've got some maintenance officers who are employed by the department. You've then got the NPA-appointed maintenance prosecutors. In KZN, they're there. They work together. Although there's communication problems that should be easy to resolve, but don't seem to be. I mean, just getting them to talk to each other. But I think in other parts of the country, those maintenance prosecutors have been taken away. They've been given other functions. So it's a question of how many, have you got enough staff dealing? Firstly, what are the backlogs you wanted to look at resolving 80% of the applications. I mean, I agree with Debbie. What's the backlog of applications for maintenance, province by province? Question one. Question two, what are you doing? If there is a backlog, what are you doing to deal with that backlog? Is it a problem of maintenance officers, not enough of them, those kinds of things. So we rather than just throwing one KPI at us on maintenance, there needs to be a far more thorough, and again, I think that the workshop format and inputs on this, a far more thorough assessment of what the problem is and what is to be done. And then you've also got the problem what's quite common, I mean, it goes on to the magistracy. What's quite common is woman has child, wants maintenance from man who's got money, but man has got money, so he's also got money to employ a lawyer. And the lawyer then takes a whole lot of unnecessary delays. I mean, I had one sort of constituency-type case where, you know, there was a blood test done that the child was a child of the father, and he paid a bit of maintenance. Then 18 years later, child wants to go to university, mother wants maintenance increased, father is a very rich man, and father's lawyer then says, no, we want another blood test. Now, total waste. I mean, you know, DNA, once you've been established as the father, you're not going to suddenly not be established as the father, and why the magistrate allowed it. And so there's also then problems with the magistrates and their attitude to women and their attitude to counsel for men, for fathers, who are just looking at unnecessary delaying tactics and things. So what I'm really saying is I don't think we can deal with maintenance with one KPA, one output rather, and a KPA under that. And I agree the 20% I don't think is adequate. We need a better analysis of what's happening, what are the problems. If there are problems, maybe it's all going well, but what are the backlogs? Why are there those backlogs? Then we can say, okay, in order to address those backlogs, these are what the KPAs should be, KPIs should be.
I don't want to repeat, but that's basically it. It's an ongoing issue. There has been improvements, but we need to look at all the different parts, the application, the court hearing, the court order, the tracing, the number of maintenance investigators. Each one of those dominoes in the whole maintenance picture should have KPIs. How many cases have been dealt with? Once an order has been granted, how many are defended? How long is the case? I have similar, many constituency queries. That's one of the main complaints, is on the maintenance issues that people come to us. And it's taking years and years to finalize. Delays, delays, delays. And then once you've eventually got your order, then the payer is you can't find it. Now you've appointed a number of maintenance investigators to trace them. That should be a KPI. how long the civil judgment is at the end of the process almost. So there's a lot that we'd like to engage in this area as well. That's absolutely at the basis of service delivery, particularly where you've got an economic recession. This is really impacts the poorest of the poor. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, except how do you ask a magistrate to accept a KPI in this matter? You can't. Yeah, I know, but then the department can quite easily argue, yes, but that magistrate is just agreeing with the defense lawyer. So what do we do then as a department? So, you know, just one little sliver.
But Chair, although they're independent, when it came to things like election courts in 2009,
you can get buy-in from them. I can't remember who raised the buy-in question earlier, but you can, you know, there's rational issues, so you don't interfere with the decision that's made in a particular case, but you can get magistrates to say, I mean, that's why you've got a justice college or whatever, you can get magistrates through the magistrates commission or the chief magistrates or whatever that look, you need to be tougher with recalcitrant fathers and their lawyers. That's all.
That's the discussion we need to have with the Chief Justice at an opportune stage, where we have every year we meet, or a few times we meet with the Chief Justice. We're not oversight, but it's sharing common concerns.
It's an engagement.
It's an engagement. And the Magistrates Commission and the Judicial Services Commission. They are the avenues as well.
Well, I mean, I need you to note, Chief Justice, I know that
he normally brings magistrates. There's normally a chief magistrate that comes this way. In the past, we've had.
I know we've had it in the past.
If the Chief Justice is holding a conference in July, I think precisely about, but exactly, these matters. And I'm sure that the legislators are also intended to attend. Perhaps you should be in touch with your office.
We can ask the Chief Justice for the Magistrates Commission.
Yeah. He has spoken publicly about it.
Yes, but not about inviting the
Justice. Okay. If a King of Justice is the same Ireland that being in the Tragic Revolution, then we're the Prime Minister.
In the past, I mean, Steve and JJ will confirm this, the Chief Justice has come to us.
Or we go to.
Or we go to. Yes.
No,
it's
not
even new. I'm just
going to go to the
Thanks, Chair.
We're looking at ways of helping the department.
Okay. That's appreciated, Chair. Chair, I won't go into the area of diversion of children's cases. I think there was a discussion earlier on it. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I wouldn't.
I want to raise a point for this
workshop. The baseline is 7%, you know, increase reduce the criminal cases of children through diversion. And then the targets are percentage baselines. Now again, as far as I'm concerned, this is going about it in the wrong way. Because we need to know how are the diversion programs working. Okay? So it's no use just saying we're going to increase the amount of children's cases diverted when we don't actually know what the programs are, how effective they are, and what the recidivism is for those children. So what we need, I think, from the department is a report on, and it's unfortunately, I think it's on, so is it yourselves or social development, but when we passed the Child Justice Act, there was a problem of not enough service providers who were doing, because it's bodies like NICRO and things that do the diversion programs, not enough spread across the country. So in order to look at this issue of implementing the Child Justice Act, the output 29A, we need that kind of input on the state of diversion service providers and their programs and their effectiveness. Because I think in PE, wasn't it, Steve, there weren't enough diversion programs. We've now, when we passed the bill, you know, you can divert even very serious cases with a required level of authority. But one of the former chairs, I think it was sort of passionate about this thing of you know, you're a child, you rape a girl, and then you get sent to some 2-month program or 2-week program, you know, and the appropriateness of programs versus crimes and things. So basically, in short, what we need for this KPI to make any sense, what we need is a proper report on the state of diversion programs in South Africa and their effectiveness.
At the same time, Dr. De Vere, I'm speaking now from my own personal experience. I'm in the habit of popping into the Pinetown Magistrates Court, and I go there. You probably won't even recognize me. I'm not wearing a suit and tie. I wear a pair of Bermuda shorts, sandals, and a button-down shirt, sort of short sleeves. But unfortunately, over time, the officials and magistrates have come to know. On this one occasion, it was a child justice case. And I was horrified to realize the magistrate hadn't read the law. So in addition to what Mr. Jeffrey is requesting, maybe someone in the department, I mean, it's less than a year now, but perhaps post-April, the department can give us a report on the Act and its implementation, including things like that. I mean, this aspect John Jeffrey is raising is very important. Yeah, and sometimes we just assume that, well, we've passed the law, and so the magistrate must read it and understand it. Well, just remember, this is a child. He's standing there. He's facing rape charges and all kinds of things. And yet the magistrate, she had to be told by the chief probation officer, "Your worship, please look at section so-and-so 49. It says the following," and he quoted from it. And she had already committed herself to a particular approach. So there she was now embarrassed. It's that kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, I'm here. You know, we asked in the National Assembly, those in favor say aye, we press the button. And my job is done. President's people look at it and say to him, please sign, and he signs. But at some point, as this committee, when these bills have become law, at some point we need to go back and say, how are we doing? I hope you agree with me on that.
It was an incredible piece of legislation, but it took almost 8 years to finalize. JJ and myself served on a subcommittee doing that. But I would like, just like we did last year with the sexual offences bill, we had a feedback as to the implementation of that. I would like to hear that. I'd like to see it. It's a pretty positive bill. I think the department's done incredibly good work, but let's hear the problems that you're experiencing on the ground. But then there's an additional element, and that is that there is diversion of adults as well. It's not only children, and that's a whole nother. We need to know how many adults are being diverted as well. I support that as well, but what are the, and that's another area of diversion that we also need to know, what is the target for that, what is the KPIs, because that's very useful to reduce your case numbers where you have that diversion taking place as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It also raises a point of concern which I've had on the Magistrates Commission as well, and that is in training of magistrates. And we raised this before the Child Justice Act came into being, and I won't say who the response was from, but the response was, oh, why do you always think magistrates have to be trained? I.e., you know, they should be able to read the law, which I agree with, but clearly they're not. And I think maybe if we're going to have a meeting where they're going to attend with us, we must also maybe flag this to raise with them and just say, you know, we are, clearly the magistrates are not getting trained adequately in preparation for new legislation, and make sure that they do, because if it comes from us, they might believe, you know, as a committee, they might then, you know, believe us more than if a few of us raise it at the commission. And yeah, I think that is a huge concern. Thanks.
I discovered in that particular case, just for your interest, was that the law provides that an assessment must be done. Now, that's social worker that does that. Social worker is based in the court, but in some cases the assessment was being done by the police, and that disturbed me. I don't know how a policeman is trained to do an assessment, but it can't be. So these are all the things, Mr. De Vere, that we need to, but at some point we will ask the department and the DG for someone to present us with a report on how this particular act is being implemented.
The point I want to make, I mean, Steve made me think about it with his reference to the Sexual Offences Act, and it would require, I think, some planning and coordination. Is there are a number of NGOs, particularly in the child justice sector. I mean, with sexual offences, an NGO did an assessment of the operation of the Act, which was useful. Okay, I mean, they do the research and things like that. So I think when we come to the implementation of the Child Justice Act, it would be useful at getting input from the NGOs in terms of the work they've done. We're not paying them or anything, but in terms of the work done, tell us how you think it's going as NGOs. I mean, so we have both a thing of hearing from the department, hearing from the NGOs, and then trying to get out ourselves.
Well, I was thinking of the people who came and worked with us on the bill. I mean, NICRA obviously are a service provider and have an interest. You know, the UWC
she was very good. It would be good to get a report from her. Alright.
The next issue has to do is 29B on the timely finalization of family law cases. And our indicator there was a percentage of family law cases finalized in each office per year. And we had set up ourselves targets. In terms of the revised targets, I think initially we had said 50% of family law cases finalized in each office per year, but I realized that in terms of the details, we have reduced it to 33%. I know that the people, the family lawyers themselves, have indicated that there are challenges in this regard because of the Child Justice Act requirements. But I think this is a matter that we would need to revise, because when I reflect on the questions that were raised earlier about the scientific basis of some of the targets that we have set, I think just with hindsight, I think we would also just like to clarify this better when we have a workshop.
Briefly as well, I think it would be useful to define exactly what we classify as family law cases, because, you know, there's so much legislation now that could be related to family law that could have that broken down to, please.
It is the family law advocate, yeah. Chair, the next point is about on the improvement of the resolution of sexual offences and implementing trafficking in persons legislation. We're in the process of developing a national policy on sexual offences, domestic violence, as well as guidelines on offences relating to lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgender, and intersex people. My understanding is that it's also a work in progress. Our target remains March 2011. On completing key activities to ensure readiness for the implementation of trafficking in persons legislation.
March 2011, please,
Jay. we will change that target there. On 30.3, finalizing key activities of phase 1 and 2 of the implementation of National Register for Sex Offenders, this is also on course. Phase 1, as I understand it, deals with current cases, and phase 2 focuses on backlogs, because there are backlogs with regard to these cases. Again, I think we are on course to deliver by end of the financial year. The next area, Chair, is an area that's supposed to be largely run. It's run from court services, but I think it will be taken over by the newly established Constitutional Development Branch. The issue of 4 additional staff, I think we have finalized all the job evaluation. I think there is staff in place. But the key point of interaction is to deal with the 31.2 to 31.6, because this was largely an area, I think there have been delays in so far as European Union funding is concerned. This is an area we are in a partnership with the Foundation for Human Rights. So I'm not in a position at the moment just to give you the detail on this because of the delays, but I think when we have a workshop, I should be able to come with more details on these targets in terms of where we are. But the targets remain as reflected in the document.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, just to take one back, sorry to do that, but 30.3 again, you say finalize key activities of phase 1 and 2. What key activities? What are the key activities that have to be finalized? Can we have details as to that? And what,
yeah, we will.
And what are the non-key activities that have to be finalized still before they are completely operation? Thanks.
Okay. My question is why is the department doing this? You're going to have community advice centers. Why? Okay. We've got the legal aid board. Then we've got the Chapter 9s, and part of their function is to promote, Human Rights Commission is promote human rights. They want offices, Public Protector wants offices all over. Now the department is opening up offices as well, and there's not enough money. I mean, the Human Rights Commission keep coming and telling us that they can't perform their functions because they don't get enough money. Why are you doing this? I understand the issue of service level agreements with civil society organizations is useful, is important, but I would have thought the Chapter 9s can go into those agreements. Why must you? So I have that problem. Then, number of aliens, refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants provided with support services. Now, you've reduced it from 10,000 to 5,000. But what's this about? I mean, what function is the department performing? I mean, firstly, it's a Home Affairs issue. Secondly, I think the bodies such as WITS Law Clinic, UCT Law Clinic, and NGOs basically have got money to set up advice offices to assist refugees. Where are these 5,000 going to get helped by the department? If I've got a constituent who's a migrant, who's an asylum seeker, can I phone somebody from the department, give me their name, to help them? How will this happen? And then the last point is compliance with the PIA Act, 100% compliance. By who? By everybody? By government? By civil society? I mean, what's the meaning of that KPI? So I think Output 31, to me, needs a lot more thought and work. And please, we have raised it before as the committee, with the Human Rights Commission as well. Address that issue. They do not have enough money. I don't think anyone can argue that.
why is the department doing some of their functions? But I'd be interested if you're able to, if you're able to, please tell us about these, why is the department getting into becoming an advice office?
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, the reason we've got those KPIs here is that there's a program that is funded by the European Union, and this program stipulates in the contract that these KPIs must sit in our strategic plan document. We have tried to take them out a few times, but apparently the contract stipulates clearly that has been signed that they must be in this. In fact, they are longer. We actually even cut them shorter, but they must be there according to the contract. And this is the funds that come from the EU. The EU stipulates as well that they no longer want to send monies to civil society organizations. They must go through national departments. So they go through our national department, and then we also have to put them on some indicators on our strategic plan. That's a complication.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
I mean, the Chapter 9s are not civil society. And really, careful, you're like waving a red rag. You can't tell us that international, well, the EU comes and determines government programs just because it's got the money. You know, so, but tell me, where is number of community advice offices, where are you establishing these advice offices? I'd just like to know that, where are you establishing those advice offices? These 5,000 refugees, asylum seekers, where do they go to get help? And how are you going to ensure compliance, 100% compliance with PAYA?
Chair, the obviously we'll give more detail when we have the workshop, but my understanding of community advice centers is that these are centers where people will seek assistance on a variety of legal and justice issues that confront them. And the emphasis was that I think the emphasis was more on your rural areas that do not have immediate access to these services. So in terms of the relationship we have with the Foundation for Human Rights, they were supposed to work with us as a department, but engage civil society organizations working with us to provide these services to rural areas. And I think there have been consultations throughout the country on this matter, but that is the idea that we are trying.
Human Rights Commission being consulted, because I would have thought if anyone was running offices in rural areas for human rights matters from government, it should be the Human Rights Commission, not the department.
What is the Foundation for Human Rights?
Is that the Paul Hoffman thing?
No, it's Yasmin Suka, I think is the Yasmin Suka is the the executive director for Foundation. My understanding is that the community advice centers are supposed to serve as areas where these refugees would go and seek help and legal assistance on human rights issues.
Then, because most of those refugees come looking for work in the urban areas, and you're opening advice offices in the rural areas.
Just the side of the border. Okay for me to cross.
Yeah, we need to be careful. Yeah. I'm not feeling good about this one. This something needs to be seriously looked at. It's fine if it's actually a conduit for money to NGOs, if that's the way they can get the money. But let's not pretend the department, the way it reads, is the department. You know, the key performance indicator for the department is to open up 15 advice offices.
No, it's the department working with a number of partners, Chair. It's not the department alone.
And please talk to Human Rights Commission.
Yeah.
Well,
you
may be happy that the Foundation for Human Rights is involved.
The name from Dr. Levy, can I give these refugees your number?
Yes, Chair, I'll refer them to the Foundation for Human Rights. Do. Okay.
And other details like the one
Okay. Chair, the next question is on PAIA.
Yeah.
Compliance with PAIA Act. And I think the intention is to have government departments complying with the PAIA Act. Not just justice. But I think that's where the complication is, Chair, because the level of compliance on the PAIA Act as well as PAIA Act is just not very good in government. In fact, so much that we have been tasked by the GNA cluster to set up an internal an interdepartmental task team led by ourselves and DPSA to just look at this area and make recommendations on how it can be improved, because I think it has been a key weakness in government.
Can I give you a bit of advice on this
matter? Some time back, when the Act was being implemented, all the DGs got a fright because there was a threat of taking a particular DG and department to court based on PAIA. Every single DG issued a directive to their departments: you don't grant any PAIA application. Those directives are still out there.
See?
They're there.
Now you tell me.
I thought you knew.
You
speak to people all over.
Yeah.
Why do you think it hasn't been working, Dee? That's why.
The unanswered question, Chair, as I said the other day, is to what degree the classification that has got out of control.
No, don't worry about classification.
The whole new proposal is none of the
Yes, why are they refusing?
But honestly,
it's because they've been, if they haven't actually received a written directive, then the DG has actually verbally said to them, you dare, and you'll be in trouble with me. That's why.
But may I please have an invitation for our subcommittee of the committee?
Well, it's there. I mean, it's common knowledge. It is. It is. And now they're tasking these poor people to fix what's there. All someone has to do is call in the DGs and say, look, there's this act. It's an act of parliament. You've got to comply. You can't just have a mute refusal.
This KPI 3317,
yeah.
My worry is that look, I think the department would say, well, they're responsible for implementation of PAIA. But functions currently, they may change, or they would change if the protection of personal information still goes through as it was introduced, so not something the committee's done, but as it was introduced. Those functions are moving from the Human Rights Commission to the regulator. In other words, so I don't know if you discussed with the Human Rights Commission about this compliance with PAIA, because they've got a statutory requirement at the moment to implement PAIA, not more so than you. Even if it does move, they would still have a requirement of promotion of any human rights, including access to information. And then the 100%, I mean, really is not worth the ink. It's only a little bit of ink, but it's not worth the ink, because it's just, I mean, presumably somebody felt, well, we can't say we'll only do 80% compliance with PAIA because of the duty on us to comply with PAIA. But you really, well, what we need is a PAIA implementation program. Sounds as though you are doing other stuff. The EPSA, I would imagine, would be key, but this ink here is wasteless.
Should this be there? Responsibility.
Well, it should be the Human Rights Commission, really. I suppose that we need more clarity on that. I don't think that it's
personal. I think this should come
out
to
myself.
Yeah. Okay. All the first ones. I mean, I think that piece of information is very important, and it should be in the public domain. It should be conveyed to everybody who works in the field.
Well, Mr. DeVere, I think you need to go back and
yes.
Ask whether you should be blunt with this. I don't think so, Steve. Really.
I just think, what does the Act say? Does the Act not say the administration of the Act is under the Minister, but the Human Rights Commission has an obligation?
Yes.
That's the Human Rights Commission that is basically responsible for this. of just thinking all our acts are administered by some minister. So that might be only in that regard. But the other issue is, of course, our speaker's office that we're going to have a briefing from. They need to help us help the Human Rights Commission enforce and use the teeth in higher self-defense. Inner rights, they just to use
that. If we're taking that away from them and giving it to the regulator,
they could pile them. Well, but that is an issue that I think we need to
address. We'll bring it to you, what did you say?
Face Mario.
But do we take it up? That's do we take it up?
Well, I don't know. I think they need to rethink this. I think you've given yourself a responsibility that you shouldn't have. Unless it's your minister that said you must do this.
How much resources
are you employed? So much time creating subcommittees and tasking. Just think about it, Dr.
Yes, I will, Chair.
I'm not saying there mustn't be compliant. Don't get me wrong. There has to be, but I'm not sure that it's in your domain. Either the Human Rights Commission or at some later stage the proposed regulator. That's where it should fall. I fear that come next year, this time, we're going to be saying, guys, how much compliance do we have? And we're going to be saying, you know, we've only got 2%.
2 minutes, a very important question that you've just raised has to be the three given to us. Given that there's a commissioner that we still need to appoint, but due to capacity constraints, there's an extra commissioner on the Human Rights Commission that is not appointed. Due to lack of funds. They're the ones that are subject to the regulator. But of course, if they're giving funds, then that should go to the Human Rights Commission. Let them do their work for them.
Yeah. All right. I also tagged this when I was going through it. I really didn't think we should do it. That's my own personal view.
Okay.
So all I can say to you is just go back and have a look at this.
Okay, sure. Thanks. The next output 32, has to do with increasing output in legal research and legislative instruments. And the key performance indicator has to do with the number of bills, subordinate legislative instruments, and research publications finalized.
That's for us. That's for the committee to give us a KPI. Finalizing bills.
I don't know. Dr. Devere, I don't know who, you know, it did read output, conduct legal research, prepare and promote justice legislation, KPI, develop priority legislation, instruments to improve access to justice and transform justice in the country. That's what it read. I'm not sure who wanted you to change it, because I think it was fine. What you've got now is like 12 bills a year, 14 regulations, and 15 research publications. I mean, it's meaningless. You know, legislation comes when there's a need. We've got more legislation. I mean, I don't know if we can cope with 12 bills, but it's just meaningless. I mean, that every year you're going to have 12 bills. And then presumably, is this not Law Commission? I mean, they do your legal research.
We will use largely the South African Law Reform Commission on this.
But you're not, and then there's a complaint from them that they do reports and they take years to be implemented. And if you look at some of the legislation that we've got, the Law Commission has just been introduced. I mean, let's say harassment. There was a Law Commission report. I mean, I can't remember the year of it. And Muslim marriages was a Law Commission report. We're still waiting for the bill. But I just think this is meaningless. I mean, I think it was fine as it was. Well, did the AG tell you you must change it? And if the Auditor General said you must change it, I don't think the Auditor General properly understands or his people properly understand legal processes. You know, I mean, we have a Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, as you know, which is a whole
lot of bills that we amend, laws, acts that we amend. I can see, I mean, it wouldn't happen, but I can see somebody, I mean, your officials have got more sense, but I could see somebody saying, gee, you know, we haven't come with 12 bills, so instead of, we're six short, so instead of one judicial matters, let's like have, we're amending five bills in judicial matters, let's do, yeah, no more omnibus bills, let's do a separate magistrates' courts amendment bill, and this amendment bill, yeah, that's what technically could happen with your KPI of 12 bills, so that's it's a terrible target.
But they don't introduce 12 bills a year, that's what they say.
No.
12 every year.
You can ask the South African Law Reform Commission, they don't say that. Sometimes their investigations take a year. I just wonder. Have a rethink on this. Or go back to the previous draft.
Yeah. No, thanks, Chair. The next point, Chair, is about the provision of legal services to the state organs. We want to improve provision of legal advisory services to provincial and national departments. We want to increase percentage of legal opinions and international agreements finalized within 21 days of their date of entry. And the targets that have been set by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor is 90%. That we want to finalize 90% of these legal opinions and international agreements within 21 days of the date of entry. The next one, Chair, has to do with increasing efficiencies in defending the national and provincial departments from negative legal action. This is mainly the State Attorney's Office. We want by March to have developed a blueprint policy framework just indicating what improvements we want to effect in the State Attorney's Office to increase the efficiencies thereof. The next one, Chair, has to do with again, on improving provision of legal service to the state organs to develop and implement litigation strategies for the reduction of legal costs paid by the department. And in terms of improving percentage reduction in the department's legal costs, we have set those targets for this financial year, 10% below 2009 baseline, the following year, 15% below 2009 baseline, and 2012, 2013, 20% 2000 below 20% below 2009 baseline, and so on. For 2013, 2014 is 25%, and 2014, 2015 is 30%. The next one, Chair, has to do on the transformation within the system, the justice system.
Workshop to discuss this whole issue of civil litigation by the state. We know state attorneys are probably one of the biggest offices in the country in the cost of litigation, and the costs are huge. I think what is negative, I don't understand negative legal action, but it's generally, it's from legal action.
Legal action,
the
yeah.
State is a plaintiff, the state sues parties, medical, contracts, lots of other, but at least mainly a defendant. So we need to look at that increase in efficiencies. The issue of litigation, it's an issue that we've raised in the past. Who decides? You have a department that is the client department, comes to the state attorney. The state attorney takes legal advice from counsel and says, settle this matter, the department says no, it's fine. Continually.
Yeah.
And that shoots up legal costs. And they settle it after 10 days in court.
Or just before they step into court.
And this shoots up the legal costs. On a parastatal basis, we know the road accident fund is probably the main cause for the blockages in Pretoria, because those cases are all settled on the day of court. They're not
Russia Gate is set up, and when I sat on transport, it was an ongoing problem. They don't have the capacity. I hope it's changed. But you deal with any case until there's a court date. So they don't settle it when you wait 3 or 4 years, and that whole, you know, Pretoria, how tough it is with RA cases. But just to get to the core work of the State Attorney's Office, the issue relates to looking at the Public Finance Management Act. Who decides? If the State Attorney and Justice says this case must be settled, then it must be settled. Or how are we going to deal with it? They're the ones who best choose it, but then the department says, no, we don't have the money now, we'd rather run it and we'll pay later. Then you fall back on the State Liability Act we discussed it yesterday.
In that situation, is it not the department's concern?
It does, but if it's state money, my experience is it doesn't matter. Even if you have a punitive costs order, unless there's a sanction that the official must pay those costs personally, which is far reach, the state just pays. It doesn't matter. The state just pays hugely, and that's where this is a very positive thing to cut down on state legal costs. But it's not the department, it's not justice's cost. You recover that from the client department. You pay them up front and then you recover it at a later stage. But look at police, for example. Their civil litigation is billions and billions of rands. Besides the judgment, their legal costs is huge. And I think this is an area that we can really look into as to how to cut down on state expenditure in some way.
I think, Dr. Levere, you need to flag this one.
Just to expand on that as well, I mean, the police, the litigation costs are high, but the settling rate, or finalization rate, is pathetically low. I think it's something like 1% of cases. So, and that does seem to be a strategy in many departments, is to just refuse to settle any case whatsoever. They leave it going on and on and on, and that raises huge amounts of costs. Whereas if you can just look at this and get an honest assessment, look at the case law, and make a fair judgment as to your amount to settle it, then you will save a huge amount of money. I think you need to try and do some kind of negotiating between all the different departments on that score.
Chair, the
what is PDI?
Previously disadvantaged individuals.
Just two issues. It's implement a council briefing policy to promote transformation within the judiciary. I mean, before it was that was there before. Okay, implement the, now it's a, okay, implement a council briefing policy. It was the council briefing policy. My problem is I'd like to, you know, it's not just a matter, transformation is not just achieved by briefing previously disadvantaged individuals, it's also how you do things. So for example, if you've got a complex case, you could have a experienced white advocate, silk, and then you take a previously disadvantaged individual as a junior, you know, to get the experience. So it's there needs to be quite a complex policy to ensure that this is working. You've also then gone from 65%, you're aiming in up until 2014 to get up to 85% briefings. That's new, okay? Have you thought that through? Because remember, it's an issue of experience and winning cases, and then it's also the kind of cases that you're giving. So somebody starting out that you're effectively mentoring, there's a lot of sort of and that is battling to establish themselves financially in court. There's a lot of sort of ordinary motions, unopposed motions that you can give them, which is bread and butter money, which can assist them. So I think there needs to be a more, one would want to get more to grips with what is happening. I mean, the bottom line is, I don't know if anybody can tell me the figures offhand, but if you take the Cape bench, here, Cape Town, not bench, bar, you know, I think the figures are like, you know, the number of African counsel is shockingly low. and has not been improving. Okay, and that's why I'm saying the policies need to address questions of mentorship. So take in a junior council, black council, African council, when you help their training. Give them the bread and butter money. Don't give that to white council, etc. And then also in the Western Cape scenario, or is there a distinction between PDIs? Because in Western Cape is quite a large coloured population. So there are coloured attorney firms who, because often it's the race of the attorney firm is the race that briefs the advocate. So you'd have far more coloured attorney for firms than briefing coloured counsel. And so is a coloured person or an Indian person in the Western Cape regarded the same as an African person, where your number of African attorney firms are very minimal? That's why African counsel get in the Western Cape have a problem getting briefs. But in your policy, are you just treating everybody as PDI?
So it's what I'm just saying is it's complex, it's more nuanced. In KZN, you might find that
look, there's a large number of Indian attorneys firms briefing Indian counsel. Therefore, you know, Indian counsel advocates do not necessarily need the same number of briefs, etc., and shouldn't be regarded then equal to you know, what we're aiming at is the number of transformation of the bar, and ensuring effectively more black advocates and African advocates in particular, and not just advocates, silk.
I think the principle you've got to is good. It's not only what Mrs. Jeffrey is just trying to address is the actual
that's
involved in the invitation.
And have you engaged, the profession? What's the advocate transformation, etc., on what they think you should be doing.
So some of the issues that you raised, of course, are answered by the law. And you also differ
with employment equity and the others. They will tell you what you may do in a province or irrespective of a province. Aren't there amendments coming through right now being proposed to employment equity that will require of businesses and institutions in the Western Cape to follow the national demographic, notwithstanding the colour of the people who actually live in the Western Cape. So, I mean, all of that is going to be determined by the law also.
Okay. Chair, I would like to take the advice that I've been given, and I will raise it with my colleagues, especially on the nuances and engagement with the profession, because I'm not in a position to say how far we have gone with engaging the profession on this matter. The next.
Thanks. It's just a short remark based on what Honorable JJ has said. I think his suggestions have a lot of implications for law schools as well.
Lose cases
convince the executive authority to appeal when they actually have no chance of appeal. But the advocate, the private advocate, sees government as a cash cow. So, you know, appeal all the way up and lose it all the way up and get the money. So I think really the issue would be, is there any kind of register of success rating? And I think it would be linked to obviously government would want to defend the case that's not winnable. And the attorney, the advocate, could decide it's not winnable, but they could be asked to proceed. That shouldn't be held against them. But what one wants to catch out is the counsel who, particularly advocates, who are giving faulty opinions and some kind of register of that, where a counsel potentially advises a particular course of action, which the department then follows and leaves the counsel to do, and they keep losing it. I mean, that counsel should be then not used again. If it keeps happening. I mean, obviously, law is things can be won, things can be lost. Don't hold a loss against this person. But if there's a potential thing of, what I'm really trying to find out is those counsel who keep advising a course of action that is in all likelihood will result in nice briefs for them and lots of money, and they keep losing it and promising the government then lots of money through the advice that they give. And a register to pick those up. Is there anything? Has any thought been given?
Not a blacklist to register.
Yeah. No, Chair, I think we have a record on who was given what case and whether they have won or not. I don't have the details of it now, but maybe in the workshop I think we would share the information.
Chair, just maybe hopefully if we can look whether it's on there, whether the question of the opinion is given, because I think one particularly wants to pick up when they gave wrong opinions. I don't think you can hold it against lawyers if they were asked to defend unwinnable cases, but where they advised that this is a winnable case, that's what you want to pick up, and they lost it.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Chair, the next set of issues really pertain to the Master's office. The one is that we want to improve access to probate services. I think probate services are really basic services that are offered by a Master's office on wills, on trusts, on estates, and so on. And we have set ourselves a goal of capacitating at least one main magisterial court per district to deliver probate services. For this financial year, we had targeted 340, for the next financial year, 62. But I think my colleague wanted to just give additional information on that.
Chair, I just wanted to add that the 62 in the second year looks like it's a big drop, but it's just the remainder of the districts that need to be capacitated. Thanks.
KPI number one, when it comes to this objective, appoint chief master. Okay. KPI number two, ensure that provincial masters are appointed. So I think, you know, it's again the same as some of the other ones. You need maintenance. You need to look holistically at the problem. And I don't think these KPIs and targets help. Some of them do like the capacitating thing, but I would have thought it's an issue of the vacancy rate across in the master's office. Why so much? And a special target to reduce that. Secondly, you've got targets of finalizing estate finance, but what about your systems, your document management, your computerization? I mean, I don't know how that has gone, but I would have thought you should look at those, and once you've improved those, then your because 352, a number of estate files and these figures, that's the symptom. If that's the right word, but the underlying cause of the problem, you're not actually you haven't identified or addressing. So I think you need to. For me, the problem with maintenance is vacancies and your own systems, computer systems, etc., and accounting systems. Didn't you get a unqualified audit because of the Master's Fund or the Guardian's Fund?
Yeah, Guardian's Fund.
So what are you doing about that? You know, and maybe it also boils down to the thing that we didn't have the financial stuff in the beginning. But the question I would want to ask.
Not just a point of on Guardian's fund. I think we had a clean audit.
You had a clean audit.
Yeah,
yes,
we had a clean audit. Yeah.
The point I wanted to bring up was at the beginning you spoke about all of the financial things that you were doing. The simple question we'd want to know is, are you going to get a clean audit this year? And if not, and what are you doing to ensure that you are? The sense we've got actually from presentations in the committee before is that you're not. But this presentation you've made has not prepared us for that. It's almost as if you will.
So if I may answer on the bigger issue of the qualification. I think we have qualifications on two issues. One is third party funds, another is regular expenditure. I think our main challenge, I think our irregular expenditure we are about to deal with. That is not the problem. But our key challenge is on third-party funds. And frankly, to achieve a no-audit qualification on third-party funds, you basically have to have staff in all courts who can ensure daily and monthly reconciliation properly. And at the moment, I'm not satisfied that we have reached that point. I think maybe when we have a workshop, we'll show you the plans that we have, because we do have plans in place, but I still think that we need to do a lot more to address that, because that's really our main source of qualification. So we are likely to get qualified because of third-party funds.
But,
Jay,
you see, this is the
problem of how you're coming in at things. In that, remember we had, and I didn't prepare or have the reports, but we had the presentation, the quarterly report or whatever. As far as I remember, we kept getting told different things about how you were going to address the third-party fund problem and what needed to be done. So the one was that we were told, I think, earlier last year that we needed to have legislation. Then I think we were told, no, legislation is not needed, there's some kind of entity that you need to set up. Then there was a problem with that entity. So a clean audit is a fundamental thing that the department should be achieving. These KPIs are not addressing that. Okay. From the input, we're now at the end, but from the input, it's all buried and scattered throughout the all the KPIs. And I do think in the workshop, we need to get because we keep getting told different things, and I think if I remember right, the conclusion at the end from the DG, and I don't want to accuse her falsely, was that the department wasn't clear what needed to be done. There still was not agreement on what needed to be done to get out of the morass with the third party funds. So please let's focus at that on the clean audit as a category on its own, separated out from the KPIs, because you've confused us, I think, or you have me at least.
Yeah. Chair, I think the last two points is improved provision of guardian's fund services to the beneficiaries, and in terms of percentage of beneficiaries in receipt of services within 40 days of request, we have set ourselves a target of 80%. Ideally, we would have liked to make it 100%, and I think maybe we should, but we think that at this stage 80% is realistic. But on the administration, on improving administration of insolvency and liquidation services, we want to aim at a target of 100% in terms of percentage of insolvency and liquidation cases finalized within 15 months of registration. So I think that's about it, Chair. I think the big issue is to note all the points that have been made to prepare for the workshop in the next 2 weeks.
The Honourable Secretary.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I must first make a confession that I'm not a legal person, and I think I'm still learning in this committee. But I heard in somewhere at the beginning that you said it was a qualification, now it has been resolved. So I want to know, how good are you in communicating with the Auditor General's office? Because what I know, the Auditor General works with management letters. They issue a lot of those letters. And it is extremely important that you actually follow up on those letters. It is very crucial for you to actually respond and make the Auditor General understand your situation the way you understand it. Because what I know, the auditors are, you know, they are the, some of the most patient professionals that I know. They don't just qualify. They like to understand why you come to that conclusion, why you didn't do it, what are your impediments, what is it that was so impossible that you could not reach out to that. So, as a department, you will need to make sure that you strike that balance, that the Auditor General actually understand you the way we do, the way you, we want you to workshop us, so that we understand. Because, you know, I didn't understand a lot of the things that you were saying. And I think the Auditor General too is not a lawyer. He may not understand you the way these learned friends understand you. So try and improve on that. Try and make sure that there is no single management letter that you have not responded to, so that you can get a better love letter from him. Thank you. Okay. Thanks.
I thought that was just advice, which we take seriously. Thanks, Jay.
Dr. Devere, madam, thank you very much. We've come to the end of our briefing session. I'd like to think we've made good progress. The proposed workshop, I'm certainly looking forward to, Fanani, Dr. Devere. It won't be a one-day thing. I can't see it. The issues are numerous, and it's going to take a lot more than just one day. But I'll leave those arrangements in the hand of Vanani, Dr. Devere, and Christine, so that they consult and work out just when it's going to happen. And then we'll get back to you. I want to thank honorable members for their inputs and participation. It's been a learning experience for me. And with those words, we're adjourned.